everyone. I'm Grace Beatty, and welcome to Wicked Women, the podcast. Step back in time with me as we learn about some of the most infamous and maligned women in history. Speaking with leading experts, I will discuss these women's backstories and the circumstances that gave them the title of Wicked. In this season of Wicked Women, I will be focusing on some well-known and some lesser-known women in history who have acquired an unsavory reputation. In the end, this podcast does not look to excuse or dispute the wrongs committed by some of these women, but it is also not looking to completely villainize them. Instead, I hope this can be a conversation starter on the complicated legacies prescribed to women in history. In today's episode, I will be analyzing the life and legacy of Agrippina, a woman who was the sister, niece, wife, and mother of Roman emperors, including the infamous Caligula and Nero. Discussing Agrippina's life and legacy with me today will be historian Dr. Carrie Fleiner, the senior lecturer of classical and medieval history at the University of Winchester, whose area of expertise includes Imperial Rome. Continue listening to learn more about this maligned and misunderstood woman from history. Let him kill me so long as he reigns. These are reportedly the words spoken by Agrippina when she was told by an astrologer that her son, Nero, would become the Roman emperor, but he would also murder Agrippina. When making a list of the wickedest rulers in history, Nero is usually near the top, a bloody Roman emperor who burned Christians during parties. His mother, Agrippina, has often been blamed for the monstrous reign of her son. Her name has become synonymous with incest, murder, greed, and manipulation. In reality, very little is known about the woman behind the myth. As historian Emma Suthan writes in her biography on Agrippina, as a woman, Agrippina exists only when her actions impact on the lives or actions of men in the political or military sphere, because in the ancient world, as a woman, she exists only through her relationship with men. Agrippina was born into a world of wealth, privilege, and confines. There was no guarantee that she would be remembered by history. She just as easily could have become one of the many faceless and nameless women from antiquity. However, Agrippina fought for her memory to live on. She was a woman who was trained in the confines and expectations of Roman womanhood, and blatantly decided to disregard them. This fast secured her a place in the history books, but often not a favorable one. To later historians, her assertiveness, ambition, ruthlessness, and political intelligence made her unnatural, more man than woman. Agrippina the Younger was born Julia Agrippina in CE 15 in a Roman outpost town in what is today Cologne, Germany. She was the first daughter and fourth child of Germanicus Caesar and Vipsania Agrippina, also known as Agrippina the Elder. Agrippina was born 2 years after the birth of her brother, who would go down in infamy as the Roman Emperor Gaius, more commonly known to history as Caligula. Agrippina and her siblings were sent to live with their maternal grandmother Antonia and her great-grandmother, the previous Empress Livia, in Rome around CE 18. A year later, her father died in the German provinces, and her mother returned to Rome. Vipsania quickly blamed Emperor Tiberius for her husband's death, and worked to increase the influence of herself and her family. In CE 29, Vipsania was exiled from Rome, but her daughter was commanded to remain in the care of her grandmother. Vipsania would die of starvation in CE 33. Leaving Agrippina an orphan. Agrippina would have received the typical education for an upper-class Roman girl. This would have included lessons in Latin and Greek, reading and writing, household management, art, literature, and basic finance. By 13, Emperor Tiberius arranged a marriage between Agrippina and Gnaeus Domitius Ahenbarbus, a man from an influential Roman family. There is very little record of Agrippina's first marriage, but according to Roman historian Suetonius, Gnaeus was a man who was in every aspect of his life detestable. As the Emperor Tiberius's health began to fail, he chose to adopt Agrippina's brother Caligula as his heir, a common practice in Roman royal dynasties. The year CE 37 was a year of massive change for Agrippina. Emperor Tiberius died after a long illness. Her brother Caligula ascended the throne as emperor, and Agrippina gave birth to her only child, Lucius Domitius Ahenbarbu, nicknamed Nero. Agrippina herself described his birth in her now lost memoirs. While the memoir itself doesn't survive, later historians reference it at times, especially in the description of Nero's birth. Here's Dr. Carrie Fleiner on Agrippina's memoir and some of the sources that we use today to understand Agrippina's life.
They're definitely from the contemporary period. So it's going to be Suetonius and Tacitus in particular, because they're the closest in time. And then Dio Cassius is about 150 years later. They are all three not using each other as sources, but they are all three dipping from the same well of sources, if that makes any sense. Again, Suetonius is a biographer, and he's very sensational. His first two of the 12 Caesars are less sensational because he had access to all the senatorial records, to all the official records and all that. And then he had a falling out with the emperor, and he found that what sold was sensational stuff. So he's the Kitty Kelly, which I know is a really old reference, of his day. So it's that kind of biography that people, it's a page turner. People want to know what kind of mad stuff's going on. And as a biographer, he's teaching moral lessons. So it's not how we would read history or biography for, you know, what happened and can we piece together trends in the history. And Tacitus is an old rhetorician. So of course he's interested from the point of view of senatorial aristocracy. Tacitus is unusual as a Roman writer because he sees a great value in resources from women. And that's unusual. So Tacitus does use women's letters. For example, Agrippina herself wrote a memoir. That tends to surprise people when they find out that she wrote. And he's got some direct quotations in his annales from that. So he felt that sort of domestic soft side could be very useful for informing his histories and his accounts. But because they are sensational, because they are critical of the emperors about whom they're writing, they bring out the worst in the women. Not so much because it's about the women, but it's because the menfolk can't keep the women under control, or the men aren't aggressive enough to have the women be the calm domestic half of their rule. Will you stop that? He wants attention, so he's knocking everything over. That they would want them to be ideally. Because these sources, Dio's in Greek, but Suetonius and Tacitus are Latin. And it's going to be Suetonius in particular who survives. So Tacitus is going to be lost for about 1,000 years. But Suetonius is copied by the Carolingians. So it's luck of the draw that he survives, because it's your man Einhard who uses Suetonius as a model to write his biography of Charlemagne. All of a sudden there's so many copies of Suetonius. And again, it's that sensation of the biography in Latin that gets copied and copied and copied, and this is how these stories get passed down. And as far as popular culture goes, your man Nero is going to be continuously a historical villain throughout time. He goes very, very quickly from being a historical person to a folkloric character. You've not only got the big three there having a go at him, but he is like a poster child for the Christians when it comes to one of the biggest villains in Christian history. So that's another reason why the Nero story just builds, and we've got this crazy image of Nero. So for Nero and his mother, you've got about 2,000 years worth of cultural baggage. So it is very hard to move around all of that. And not only to look at our written sources, there's about 30 different written sources for Nero. And that's where you can also find Agrippina. And that also surprises people when I say that. But you've also got, for example, all the imagery, all the coinage. You have to look at those images that are being promoted, contemporary images. And again, as you ask, is this modern stuff or contemporary stuff? There's a very famous statue. People can run right now and go do a Google image search of Nero and Agrippina when he is first being, I don't want to say crowned, but he's first being announced as emperor. And it's very famous because he's a young boy, and it looks like she's sticking a crown on his head. She's actually not. She's in the guise of the goddess Ceres, probably, and she's got a cornucopia. He's supposed to be part of what's coming out of the cornucopia. That's why she's got the leaf on his head. My point is, that's showing her giving her bounty to the Roman people. So she's not crowning him. She's not making him emperor. She's presenting this descendant of Augustus to the Roman people. That statue wasn't discovered until the mid-1970s, and it's part of an enormous temple from Aphrodisias, which is out in the Greek world, and it's a Sebastian. So Sebastos is Greek for Augustus, so it's the same word. So you've got this temple, it's out in the Greek world. You not only have this statue of Agrippina and Nero, but there's a very famous statue of Agrippina and Claudius. There are statues there of Nero and Britannicus as children clasping hands because they're joint heirs. And again, none of that was discovered until the 1970s. So you have all these people writing about Agrippina prior to that time, only using the literary sources. And you see what a difference it makes when suddenly you say, wow, this is not only a contemporary source showing a positive view of Agrippina, it's from an outsider point of view. Why would somebody from outside of Rome, looking into Rome, be presenting her in such a positive light? So multidisciplinary studies and looking at multiple types of sources is so important for reconstructing and I think sort of unpacking some of the more lurid tales. There is, she's died now, but there was a historian on Nero who also studied Agrippina to some extent. She has identified a number of passages in Suetonius that she makes an argument may have also come from the memoir. This type of work that Agrippina wrote, and it's referred to by Tacitus as well, would have been called a commentarius. And that is something that a military general would have written when he retired. So Julius Caesar's The Gallic Wars is a commentary. His commentaries on the wars, commentaries on the Civil War. And it's interesting that her memoir is given that title because it is associated with retired generals. And according to Tacitus, she told him that she was writing this memoir and she was going to expose to the whole world what an absolute stinker he was, and that she was you know, taking names and, you know, she was going to publish this just to try to manipulate him. More likely, it was domestic stuff. So it's because of the three quotes that we know are absolutely from her, it's the kind of stuff that a woman would have been interested in writing about. So the information about the breech birth, for example. Or I think one of the other quotes is that Agrippina had three eye teeth. So we've all got two incisors and she had three. She had an extra one. And there's a couple other little things domestic. And it's thought by Miriam Griffiths, for example, that a lot of the stuff we know about Agrippina's mother in Suetonius and in Tacitus especially is probably a result of them having access to this memoir. So it would have been part of the historical record. It's a shame it doesn't survive because the Julio-Claudians very carefully curated the historical record. There are no historians from that actual period. When they learnt of somebody who was writing a history, it was confiscated. So they wanted to shape their own history and what was put into the record. So your boy Tacitus and Suetonius, they're much later. They're after another generation of emperors. So, Claudius was a historian and his work was confiscated and destroyed. So is that what happened to Agrippina's stuff? Dunno. But there is one guy who's kind of a contemporary historian, but he was such a kiss-ass. He's during the reign of Tiberius, so this is the second emperor, and he's so sucky. He really kisses up to Tiberius, and it's not quite a history, but he was considered such an inferior writer that he wasn't translated into English until earlier this century. So when I wanted to use him at school when I was an undergraduate, I had to read the Latin because nobody, he's in the Loeb series now, it's a guy called Valerius Maximus, but you get a Teubner text, which was a Latin edition. But yeah, people thought, why bother? But he has a lot of interesting anecdotes, so he's quite interesting. He didn't like Julia, so he went after her. Well, it's not only, I mean, you've got her memoir, but there's also embedded evidence in Suetonius and Tacitus that these women in the Julio-Claudian family were prolific letter writers as well. And all of those letters would have gone into the state archives. Because this is what Tacitus tells us. Oh, you know, Julia wrote this letter to Augustus. And Suetonius says, oh, you know, Livia wrote this letter to Augustus or whatever. The reason that Agrippina was busted by Caligula at that treason trial was because he had letters. He said, I have letters in her handwriting to prove that it was her. And of course, then you find out later that, not in that particular anecdote, but as you keep reading, you find out that Augustus had very distinctive handwriting, and he taught all of his grandchildren to have this particular handwriting. So it sounds like there was a distinctive Julio-Claudian hand. So Caligula could have just written his own letter saying, yes, my sister hates me. But it's very interesting that that's the evidence against her, was letters in her own hand.
Suetonius claims that upon receiving congratulations for the birth of his son, Gnaeus replied, I don't think anything produced by me and Agrippina could possibly be good for the state or the people. Caligula had a close relationship with his three surviving sisters, Agrippina, Drusilla, and Livia. In the early years of his reign, he showered his sisters and their husbands with favors. They were included in oaths, they were allowed to join the emperor in his private box during games, and their faces often appeared on the reverse side of coinage, the first women in Roman history to be depicted on coinage. Later historians such as Suetonius, Tacitus, and Cassius Dio claimed that Caligula had incestuous relationships with all of his sisters. This accusation has stuck with Agrippina throughout the centuries. But other than histories written years after her death, no contemporary record of incest exists. A year after her brother became emperor, Agrippina became involved in a coup attempt. There is little record of the event, and some later historians have called into question the validity of the charge. What is known is that in CE 39, Agrippina, alongside her sister Livia, was charged with adultery and conspiracy. Agrippina was exiled, just as her mother had been. But her ultimate fate did not mirror her mother's. Here's Carrie.
She went to live at Caligula's court. She wasn't really interested in living with her first husband. And Caligula, as everybody knows, was very fond of his sisters. But at one point, she was implicated in a treason trial against Caligula, and he had her banished. So this is how Nero becomes more or less orphaned when he's about 3 years old. And Caligula liked to humiliate people when he punished them, if he didn't actually execute them. And her humiliation was to be sent away to this island in exile. And her job was to join the slaves who dived for sponges. So the Romans used sponges in the baths and what have you. So she was forced to do this, very humiliating. But it meant that she became a very good swimmer. So I tell my students, hold that thought. Hold that thought.
In CE 41, after Caligula was assassinated, Agrippina was recalled to the Roman court by her uncle and the new emperor, Claudius. Agrippina would have realized that her power at court would depend on the men in her life. Without a husband and her brother no longer emperor, Agrippina would have had no political role in court. Therefore, she set her eyes on a wealthy and influential man named Crispus and reinserted herself into the court, and soon rose in favor with her uncle. It appears that Agrippina's life remained largely uneventful in the first 5 years of her marriage. Crispus died in CE 47, while Agrippina inherited his fortune. Later historians from antiquity would claim Agrippina poisoned her husband for his wealth, but the rumor was never proven. A year later, her uncle Claudius had his wife, Messalina, executed for a failed coup attempt alongside her lover. Afterwards, Claudius saw his niece Agrippina as a solution to his rising unpopularity in the face of his wife's treachery. Historians from antiquity claimed that Agrippina seduced her uncle and manipulated him into making her his wife and consort. The reality was that the marriage was beneficial to both sides. Claudius married into one of the oldest and most influential bloodlines in Rome, and Agrippina rose to the most prominent position for a woman in the country. Soon after their marriage, Claudius officially adopted Agrippina's son, Nero, and began preparing him to succeed him on the event that he and Agrippina did not have heirs. Numerous later accounts portray the adoption of Nero by Claudius as an almost obsessive dedication by Agrippina to see her son ascend the throne. Stories, such as the famous quote, "Let him kill me so long as he reigns," came to define her legacy as an overly ambitious mother. However, the choice of Nero as heir was a logical political move. Claudius had a biological son, but he was much younger than Nero and believed to suffer from epilepsy. By naming Nero his heir, Claudius ensured a smooth succession after his death. Agrippina quickly became a trusted and loyal advisor to Claudius. She was granted the title of Augusta, a rare occurrence for the wife of an emperor, and promoted peace amongst the warring factions of her husband's court. At the age of 63, Claudius died in 54 CE, and Nero, at 16, became emperor, the youngest ever to be crowned. However, in the initial hours after Claudius' death, Nero was unaware of his new status. And historian Emma Suthan wonders, until she made the official announcement, she was empress, and there was no emperor. And I wonder if, for a heartbeat, she considered taking it for herself. Just a single heartbeat, because she was too pragmatic and sensible and aware of the realities of the world to really try it. But just for that heartbeat, do you think she was tempted? For generations, Agrippina has once again been blamed for the death of her husband. All three of the famous chroniclers, Suetonius, Tacitus, and Cassius Dio, claim that in another desperate act to make her son emperor, she had hired doctors to poison Claudius. However, the accusations are rarely followed up with proof, leaving the truth behind one of the most defining parts of Agrippina's legacy in the shadows. With Nero emperor, Agrippina saw her power rise to new, unprecedented heights. Agrippina seemed to stand on equal footing with her son, a fact that horrified historians such as Tacitus, who bemoaned, Agrippina could tolerate giving her son the empire, but not him being emperor. Carrie discusses this misconception about Agrippina's life.
I think the most common misconception is that she wanted to be emperor herself, and she knew that she couldn't be because she was a woman. So she either tried to rule through Claudius, her husband, or she tried to rule through Nero. And I think if you step back, you realize that she was a very good helpmeet to Claudius. He was not intended to become emperor, so he was not raised to have the education of a public servant. It was thought that he was a fool. It was thought that he was physically disabled, which in Roman times meant that you were foolish because they took very seriously what kind of physical condition you were in. She herself had had two husbands prior to Claudius, this older senator, and then she had been married off to an older lawyer. So by the time she gets to Claudius, she seems like she's very well educated. And the Julio-Claudian women in Augustus's family, her great-grandfather, would have been very well educated. And you find, if you read the sources very carefully, there's a lot of letter writing between her and Claudius. There's indications that she helped him with some of his speeches. There's indications that she took embassies on his behalf, so she heard clients on his behalf. So she was very actively involved. And that doesn't mean that she was trying to take over, because Livia held very similar roles. So these are things people would have been accustomed to. And by hearing clients, it doesn't mean that she was doing diplomatic missions necessarily. The wives of the emperors heard very specific petitions. You know, if you speak to the wife, maybe she can get forgiveness for, you know, my exile, or, you know, go to the woman to ask for favors from the man, sort of thing. As I said, when Nero became emperor, he was only 16. He had been supported by Claudius, so it wasn't her just muscling her way in. Claudius did have a natural son. He was a little bit younger than Nero. He was very sickly. And by having Nero as Claudius's heir, that's sort of shoring up stability for his own reign. Nero's a direct descendant of Augustus and Claudius isn't, so that's more stability there. This is all very well endorsed. This wasn't Claudius being a bumbling idiot as he's portrayed in the media. Nero just didn't have that much experience. He'd been doing some public events, but it was more like the equivalent of opening a supermarket or just being with Claudius on the grandstand. You know, the royal family does this now, so they're already bringing like Prince George to events, and he's wearing his little suit, you know, sort of like very slowly growing up in a public role. And Nero just did not have any experience. Although just a little while before Claudius died, Agrippina actually put out an announcement saying that if anything were ever to happen to Claudius, Nero would be capable of succeeding. And of course, you look at this in hindsight and you go, wow, that's really sinister. But it's reassuring. And if you read through the sources of Claudius's reign, that's what his reign was all about, was stability, and that there was going to be somebody who followed him. And she plays a big role in that. So in answer to your question, one of the things that, you know, I try to teach, whether it's to my students, which is going to be more focused, or in like a general history association thing, is that when you think about modern politicians, I mean, I grew up with Ronald Reagan being president, and everybody said, oh, Nancy's the actual power behind the throne. That sort of thing. Or Hillary Clinton was working the puppet strings on Bill Clinton. That sort of thing. This is what we have going on. And of course, there's 2,000 years of baggage between us and Agrippina to build those stories. But it's a very similar thing, I think.
Nero seemed uninterested in the job of ruling an empire. And so in the early part of his reign, he allowed his mother full control. She sat in on meetings and listened to Senate sessions from behind a curtain. To all intents and purposes, Agrippina was the true power behind the throne. This went against all contemporary notions of femininity. But as Carrie points out,
what I find most interesting about her is the usual response that I get from people, because I do a number of popular history talks, and everyone's like, oh my god, didn't she sleep with her son, and oh my god, didn't she poison her husband? But what I find fascinating about her is when you really get into reading, and you start doing more than just reading the sensational stuff, you realize that if this gal had been a man, she would have been really well respected, because everything she's doing is very aggressive, it's very assertive. She wasn't trying to become a ruler herself. She's trying to promote her own son. She's trying to act as a helpmeet to her husband. She's acting as a very good Roman mother. Roman mothers are really, really pushy. So all this stuff about the ideal Roman mother raising her son, doing all this sort of thing, they're supposed to jump into the background. But when you've got an inexperienced husband like Claudius, and you've got a waste of space like Nero, she had no respect for him as a kid. She's just stepping forward. She is basically that Republican mother, and she is so assertive and she is so aggressive. That's what interests me about her, because you can't be a nice person and survive in the Julio-Claudian family. She herself went through a heck of a lot in her own childhood and how she grew up amongst this vile court of people. Like I said, Caligula was her brother. And, you know, just that peril from childhood, I think you are going to have to be a very hard, direct, aggressive woman. Julio-Claudian women are either these sort of shrinking violets that are very much admired, but they're also dish rags that kind of get passed around. Or they're these really forceful, aggressive women. And it's not necessarily aggressive in the pejorative sense. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying that we can't completely reconstruct her story, but it's rather fascinating to see the traits that she has and to consider them against some of the men who are admired from the time of the late Republic or the early Julio-Claudian period. And you think, if she was in a toga rather than a matron's dress, she would have been highly respected. She would have been right up there with some of these guys who were very assertive and very self-assured, I think.
Nero soon began chafing under his mother's strong will and control. Here's Carrie.
Nero's clueless. He's only 16 years old. He has no interest in being emperor. He just wants to play music and he wants to be a sports guy. So for about 5 years, she runs the empire along with his tutor. So it's a regency, unofficial regency. When he finally asserts himself, it's because of girls. Okay, so he gets a couple of girlfriends, and they're telling him, especially the ones like, no, there's no hanky-panky unless you get rid of your mom. So, you know, nothing's going to happen. So he goes nuts, and he tries to think eventually of how's he going to kill her, because she's really getting up his face. She's telling him, you don't show me the respect I deserve. You're not showing me the honor. I made you emperor. And it has to do with her bloodline, not the fact that she's murdered people. So he finally thinks, I've got to get rid of this woman once and for all.
This is when Tacitus makes one of the most egregious accusations against Agrippina. He claims that in her desperation to hold on to power, she presented herself on several occasions to her half-tipsy son, coquishly dressed and prepared for incest. However, Carrie doubts the veracity of these claims and argues that incest and sexual exploits have always been used as a way to tarnish powerful women.
Incest is a very common way of slandering somebody in antiquity. So if you've been, I've seen some of the other podcasts that you've been doing. So all the stuff that you've probably been doing on medieval women and ancient women, Byzantine women, at some point or another, they've probably been accused of sleeping with a family member, whether it's brother and sister, mother and son, that sort of thing. It's just a standard, it's a standard thing. And in the Roman period, the pagan period that I'm functioning in, it's not the immorality that you would get in the Christian era. That, oh my God, it's incest, you know, it's biblical. In my period, it's very insulting because it smacks of being Eastern. You know, because you've got Cleopatra married to her brother, or the Ptolemies who married brothers and sisters, and that. So it's very un-Roman to accuse someone. It's depraved. It's also depraved, but there's also that political element to it as well. So it's a very, very common trope. It's no different than, you know, when you've got war atrocities where everybody says, oh, everybody knows that the Germans ate babies during World War II. And my German family say, oh, no, it was the Allies doing that. You know, the Allies used to bayonet babies and that sort of thing. So both sides will have the same kind of trash talk, and it just persists. One of the things that she was accused of was using sex for political gain. So not just with Nero, but with others. When at one point when she was widowed before she married Claudius, was it Otho? It's either Otho or Galba. She went up to him, according to the sources, and was trying to seduce him right in front of his wife, who thumped her. I mean, just a roundhouse, just knocked her to the ground, saying, you know, mind your own business. If you try to think, God, was she really trying to do this? Was she really that aggressive? It's just, it's to me, you can unpack that to say that's a woman that's trying to stay alive. You have no agency as a widow in the Roman world. You are so dependent on husband, father, son sort of thing. So she is trying to attach herself in a very dangerous world to somebody that she perceives as being up and coming politically. If she's not married to somebody who's going to, you know, manipulate her to put her into this position, she's got to do it for herself.
In 56 CE, Agrippina was banished from court. She was moved to her country estate and surrounded by guards. It was soon after her banishment that Nero began devising a way to have his mother killed. This seems like a massive jump from a man who allowed his mother control in all areas of governance to planning matricide. This rapid shift in Nero has baffled historians ever since. What we do know is that Nero's first few attempts to murder his mother failed. As Carrie discusses,
again, what adds to the sensation is the many attempts that Nero made to assassinate her. He can't do it by hand himself, so he comes up with all these wacky schemes. And across the three sources, you know, I've sort of put together the schemes. Nero was very fond of the theater, and he's inspired with how he can kill his mother by seeing one of these stage shows where they flood an arena. So the Colosseum doesn't exist yet, obviously, but it's one of the arenas in Rome. It's flooded out, and there's a sea battle. And part of the sea battle are these ships that have fronts that open up. So if you think like the D-Day invasions, how the front of the ships opened up so the troops could leave. It's a very similar thing. In this case, it was animals that came running out. It was soldiers that came running out. And of course, this flooded arena is very shallow. So, you know, when they come out of the boats don't sink. But Nero's thinking, well, what if I gave my mother a boat like that? That collapsed when it was actually at sea, you know, when she's sailing back to her home across the bay from my party gaff. And just in case the sinking boat doesn't kill her, he thinks, what else could I possibly give her as a present? So he gives her this bed that is constructed to collapse when the user gets into it. So you have to imagine you had a canopy bed. So we've all seen like little princess canopy beds. This one has a lead roof. So all the draperies and all that are held up by a lead platform. So he invites her to dinner, you know, after another one of these sessions where she says, You're not paying any attention to me. You're not showing what I deserve. He's like, Mom, it's all right. Come over for a dinner party. And he gives her presents and clothing and all these wonderful things. Considering the relationship they have with each other, I don't know about you, but if I had that kind of relationship and suddenly my antagonist was being really nice to me, I'd be like instantly suspicious. But according to the story, she was just sort of, oh, well, it's about time. You know? So she comes over, she party hardies, and she's about to leave. And he's like, no, Mom, I've taken care of that as well because I've got this fantastic ship for you. She gets into the ship, this is where there are multiple stories. So, like I said, I put them all together. She gets into the collapsible bed. It falls apart in such a way that she's able to crawl out of the wreckage. And she's saying, gosh, you know, I hope he kept the receipt. Who expected that to happen? She's out at sea in the front of the boat. Of course, the whole boat collapses around her and her staff and her servants. So Nero is not on top of all of this, but from a distance, you can hear the cries for help and all of that. So he sends out a couple of his soldiers to make sure that she's dead. So these soldiers in their little canoe or whatever, the little rescue boats, calling her. And one of her handmaidens is like, oh, it's me. I'm Agrippina. So the soldiers row up to her and they beat her to death with their oars because they think, yes, it's the emperor's mother. But as you'll recall, Agrippina was a very good swimmer. So she's able to swim to shore. It's about this time she starts to suspect that maybe Nero's intentions aren't as honorable as she had imagined. So she goes back home and she pens Nero a little note, which he receives. So he's feeling very smug. He's back in the palace. He's feeling really good. He thinks, you know, job done. Hooray. And he gets this letter saying, hi, it's your mom, in case you were worried. So this is when he sends proper assassins to have her taken care of. She gets sort of the last word in because these soldiers show up, you know, in her household. They knock her to the ground. They're very brutal to her. They strike her on the head with the butt of a sword and knock her to the ground. And, you know, she's either on the ground or she's standing again, depending on the sources. And she knows why they're there. And she points to her womb and she says, strike here. This is the source of all of Rome's troubles. It's fantastic. You can understand now why one of the earliest motion pictures from Italy from about 1911 is about Agrippina. This is why Handel wrote an opera about her in the 18th century. It's fantastic stuff. But this is the stuff people pick up on. They don't want to hear the boring, well, you know, actually, when you step back from it, no, nobody wants to step back from it. They want to hear about sinking ships and you know, diving for sponges and you know, did Nero really seduce her? And, you know, after she died and Nero went to look at the corpse, did he really feel up her breasts and say, wow, what a beautiful woman she was? That's the kind of stuff that people want. So my job is to say, yeah, that's there, but...
Nero quickly began a rumor that it was Agrippina who had been trying to kill him, not the other way around, and that she had committed suicide upon being discovered. She was quickly buried in an undisclosed location. Her son's reign was swept into violence and chaos after Agrippina's death, ending with Nero's suicide in 68 CE. After Nero's death, Agrippina was moved to a tomb more befitting of her station, but the location has since been lost to history. Agrippina is perhaps one of the most infamous women from Roman history, but most of the information we have about her come from blatantly biased and negative sources. As Carrie points out,
the sort of gateway literature to somebody like Agrippina the Younger are these sensational histories. They're the big three, Tacitus, Dio Cassius, and Suetonius. And they are the ones that Hollywood and the script writers for television take. Livia and Agrippina the Younger also tend to be the Roman women that my students study at A-level, which is, you know, British college. And they only have the superficial knowledge of her because they're not doing the historiographical read and they're not doing the multidisciplinary study of the sources. So I spend a lot of time with her, both in a year one module that I do on Roman family and Roman women, Roman household, and then I teach a Julio-Claudian module for the year three students. We spend 6 weeks with Nero. So that means we get about 2 or 3 weeks with Agrippina because she's got to go through three different emperors. And I tell them, you can't just read the big three because they've got their own agenda. They're all rhetoricians, they're all aristocrats, and they're all very anti-Julio-Claudian. So of course they're going to try and make the men look weak by saying, look at these women who aren't behaving accordingly. So absolutely, when you've just got that narrow frame of reference, you're just going to get the sensational stories. And I mean, Tacitus himself even says, if I didn't throw in the exciting stuff, nobody would read my histories. So I've got to add this stuff in there. So he says it in the histories that, you know, you sometimes have more truthfulness than truth. And that also comes from Cicero. So Cicero felt that, you know, history was meant to teach people how to behave. And if you were too straightforward with it, you'd lose your audience. you know, so you had to throw in the nutty stuff, I suppose.
In many of the sources on Agrippina, she has become inextricably linked to the men in her life, particularly her son Nero. Biographers and historians alike have attempted to detach Agrippina from Nero, with varying results. In Carey's opinion,
it's very hard to isolate Agrippina from Nero. And when the historians have tried to do this, there's somebody, is it Ferraro? I can't remember off the top of my head. Back in the 1920s, he tried to say, we've got to look at Agrippina on her own. We've got to pull her away from Nero. And he swung the pendulum too far in the other direction and made her look like this very sympathetic, you know, this poor woman, she's so misunderstood. And you look at someone like Bartlett. He's got his book on Agrippina. He's got his book on Caligula. But in his book, that's Anthony Bartlett, on Agrippina, one of the things he says is, she's a hard woman. She's not a lovable person. She would not be somebody that you'd want to sit and chat with. But she has to be in order to survive the situation that she's in. So that tends to be where historiography on her falls right now, is saying, there's no way you're going to apologize for or rehabilitate her. She's not a nice person. But in terms of reevaluation, you have to stop and think, why is she so hard? So how can we reconstruct the circumstances around her that makes her behave the way she does? And I think what Barrett does is this whole idea that it's a matter of survival. How, as a woman, would you survive in a court like that? So you either have to be that sort of dish rag, and most of them end up being executed, or something terrible happens to them. They remain widely respected, but they end up being victims many times, not always. Or you end up having to be somebody who's very assertive. And sometimes I think assertion becomes associated with aggression. And assertion is a positive trait, but aggression's the negative trait. Again, as a man, she would have been assertive, and she would have been taking the active role. But as a woman, it's like, she doesn't know her place. She's acting out. She wants power for herself.
Roman history is a favorite genre of the past for both the public and historians. In recent years, there have been attempts to combine a multitude of different disciplines to better understand this fascinating chapter in world history. Agrippina has benefited from this new interdisciplinary approach. Here's Carey.
A lot of study of Agrippina, for example, that's part of the new look at her, the reevaluation of her, comes from linguists. You know, what language did Tacitus use to describe her? Because there's changes in the vocabulary. And that we weren't really doing multidisciplinary stuff when I was a student, and you were looked at as kind of strange that you wanted to marry together what you were reading in your literature class with your history class, because they're two separate things. So you've got historians who are working with other colleagues in other fields to create new reevaluations all the time. So when you think, everything's been written, it really hasn't. And there's always new stuff being discovered, especially material culture. So I think amongst historians, it's a really vibrant and exciting era to be working. I mean, one of the things I have my students do is to take somebody who is traditionally viewed as an awful person, like Tiberius, for example, even Caligula. And I'll say to them, if you had to reevaluate him, not apologize, not make him sound like a good guy, but if you were trying to look at what is this person doing in the context of you know, what was going on around them, how can you reconstruct this? And a lot of this is happening with the lives of the women who are mentioned in these sources. It's very difficult to separate them from their menfolk because they're almost always attached to them. And you end up doing a lot of reconstruction work. It's very detective work. Can be not pulled out of context, but maybe you can sort of reconstruct and fill in some of those gaps around them.
While Agrippina has been receiving a more balanced evaluation in the academic community, within popular culture, her legacy has remained relatively unchanged. This is a fact that any historian faces when their subject area is reimagined for public consumption, whether as films, television series, or novels. Carey argues,
what Hollywood has done, what pop culture has done, is they've pulled out those bits and pieces. They think, wow, this is really sensational. How can we join them up? And it just becomes this big soap opera ride. There's no attempt of saying, well, why is she being such a bad girl? You know, what's going on behind the scenes? And can you frame this in a different way that you go, hang on a minute, she's actually being very protective here, or you know, here's a more valid reason for why she's doing X rather than, oh, it's just because she was a wicked stepmother. But when you try to revise the image on a film or television show, people get annoyed because if they're watching something about Nero, they want to see him throwing lions to, you know, Christians to the lions or lions to the Christians. You know, how many films have been made about Nero with him sitting in the Colosseum? You know, and the Colosseum didn't exist at the time, but that's what people expect to see. The thing is, the Romans were doing this. The Romans had this version of plays, these little plays called praetexta, and they would act out what was happening in the imperial family on the streets. They'd have these little mime shows, and that if you've ever seen HBO's Rome. They do a very good job with that. So when you've got all the shenanigans going on with Aetia and Julius Caesar and all that, I think one of the cutaway scenes are people in the street heavily made up, overacting and pretending to be Caesar and Aetia having one of their public quarrels, because everything these people do is public. So that's very, very good, because that was a little pretexta that you're seeing there. And I think even there's a play that appeared during Nero's lifetime after his first wife was executed. And it's all about his first wife bemoaning her fate. And she's very much a victim. And Agrippina appears as a ghost. And something like The Crown has been really helpful to me, because if you watch the most recent series where Diana is painted as this victim, the royal family was so evil to her. And I remember Princess Diana. I remember all this stuff when it happened the first time. And you find yourself saying, that's not how it happened. And they didn't have Margaret Thatcher out there trying to go hunting in her high heels. That's not what really happened. But it's become part of the lore, so it becomes part of the crown. The same thing was happening even back in Nero's time. So after he has Agrippina executed, for example, there were stand-up comedians making jokes about it in front of him. So we know this was happening, and he would just laugh and applaud. He would just laugh and applaud. He liked to play on stage, and one of his favorite roles was Orestes, who in the mythology killed his mother. And he would also play Oedipus, who slept with his mother. And he would go on stage and be like, it's me, it's Oedipus. Get it? Get it? You know, so he even played into these rumors and the sensation that was being said about him. So he didn't really help matters. But we have people like that now. So you can see it happening now. You get politicians who act like buffoons. I'm not going to name any names, but they endear themselves to a particular portion of the population who think that they're just harmless clowns. So let's make this guy the leader or whatever. And it's happened on both sides of the Atlantic. At least these days, you can have a politician who does something, and there's still people alive who can say, but that didn't happen. You know, but all the people who could tell us that, all the people who actually knew Agrippina and who actually knew Nero, they're gone. So all that survives is the episodes of Have I Got News for You or The Apprentice or whatever. And you think, oh, is this what they were like? So, you know, if that's all that survives 2000 years from now, you're going to have historians trying to think, well, I've got some negative things here about the president, or I've got some negative things here about the prime minister, but all I have is you know, Donald Trump appearing in Home Alone 2, you know. So the same thing is happening in antiquity. These people are being parodied at the time. They're being mocked at the time. They're having moralizing texts written about them. So if you think of Suetonius or Tacitus and the trash talking that they're doing, and then you say, but we have similar things now, here's an example, then you understand the problems of interpretation. We are missing the context.
The concept of authenticity within historical research and presentation has been a controversial and much debated topic for generations. Some historians lambast fictional retellings of the past for their inaccurate portrayals of specific events, people, and cultures. Others believe that historical fiction provides a doorway into the study of the past for those who may not connect with history through academic means. Historical accuracy is made even more difficult in eras where very little evidence actually survives, leaving people today to interpret the past with the sources that are available to them. Historian Robert Birkhofer believes, "History, historical fiction, fictional history, and fiction all exist along a spectrum." This is Carrie's opinion when it comes to popular portrayals of Agrippina.
I don't have any issues with the sensational in pop culture. I really don't. I think it's just, it's going to continue, and it is one way for people to get to know the history. I mean, if it gets incredibly silly, then you think, if you're going to be sensational about it, at least use the stories that are in the sources. What gets up my wick is when you get historical dramas and they decide to start adding all the mental stuff. If it's in the sources, so you can say, oh, yeah, Tacitus said that. Because then you have a talking point. Because I show a lot of pop culture and I do stuff with reception in my classes. So we can talk about, well, okay, they've brought up whatever. Why is that happening? I mentioned at the beginning there's a film from 1911 that's all about Agrippina. It's about 12 minutes long. It's on YouTube. And all the intertitles are in Italian. But after we do all of our Nero stuff, because it's getting close to Christmas, end of the semester, I show that little film and I tell the students, narrate this, what's happening? So that even though they can't read the intertitles, they can say, oh, you know what that is? And oh, I can identify that person. So it's quite good that even though it is all the sensational stuff, you can see where somebody's engaging from it from a different perspective. So you can say to somebody, and I have had students do this exercise, if you take Plutarch's Life of Alcibiades, or if you try to reconstruct a biography for Agrippina from this particular source, what are you going to do? How are you going to write her life? How are you going to write a res gestae for her? So you still have that sensational stuff, but it's also asking the questions of where are there gaps? Can we fill the gaps in? And if we are going to fill those gaps in, how do we do it? So you don't want to be making stuff up completely. So I think this is where the historical aspect of it comes in, that I'm very interested in what I would call reconstructive history, where you can't fill in the specific gaps, but you can maybe reconstruct what might the life been like by taking other sources from the same time period and say, you know, I don't know what kind of curtains this woman had in her house, but a particular style that we know existed. So this might have been something that she would have seen. So I'm very interested in that. Of it's almost like taking all the little jigsaw puzzles and sort of filling the pieces in as you can. So that would be me. I think continuing the reevaluation and the reconstruction of history as best we can, and you know, allowing people to have fun with the drama, because the Romans would have, you know, the Romans were pretty sensational.
History has remembered Agrippina as vile, wicked, manipulative, sexually promiscuous, and murderous. All of the worst accusations have been hurled at her at some point in the past. Agrippina was a woman raised to be a dutiful wife and mother, hidden from public life. While we can never know Agrippina's personal thoughts, through her actions, it becomes clear that she wanted to be anything but docile. She wanted her name remembered in history, and she has been damned for it through the centuries. She used her wit, sexuality, and connections to rise to unprecedented heights for Roman women. However, the power Agrippina held made her unnatural in the eyes of the world, a woman who did not know her place. Agrippina has often been caricatured into a terrifying beast that belongs in a horror story more than the pages of history. As historian and activist Gloria Anzaldúa once wrote, "A woman with power is feared. In the eyes of the world, this makes us dangerous beasts."